Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is James Wright, who is President Emeritus and Eleazar Wheelock Professor of History at Dartmouth College. He is the 2010 Jefferson Lecturer at Berkeley. Professor Wright, welcome to Berkeley.
I'm delighted to be here, Harry, and I'm delighted to join you on this program.
And tell us a little about your background. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Wisconsin, in Madison, but I was raised in Galena, Illinois, an old mining town on the Mississippi River. Nobody in my family had ever gone to college, and so my dad had gone for a few months during the Depression. I need to correct that.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, that's an interesting question. Obviously, they did shape my thinking about the world and who I am. But I learned from them certainly discipline and the capacity to look out for myself. They are loving and supportive parents. One of my grandfathers was a miner, and the other was a farm worker. And we certainly did not have much money growing up. I remember rats in our apartment. I remember staying at my grandparents and not having lights or running water in their house. And it was a different era, but there was a lot of love and a lot of support around.
And in high school, did you have any teachers who pointed you in the direction of history, or did that all come later?
Oh, I always loved history. I loved to read history. I loved to study history. But I was not a good high school student because I never thought about going on to college, even. It was not something that was part of our culture. It was not something that was really part of my family. And I enjoyed school. Teachers would say to me, you could be a far better student, but it was never clear to me why I needed to be or wanted to be a far better student. So I was a slow starter.
And what about the interest in political history? Did that come later also?
I think that came later. After I started studying history in college and at the University of Wisconsin, I became more and more interested in political history, absolutely.
Now, you went from high school to the Marine Corps. Tell us about how that came about, and a number of your fellow students did that instead of going to college.
My high school graduating class in 1957 had 60 students. At that time, it was the largest graduating class in my high school in this small Illinois town, and so I presume half of us were boys and half girls, but whatever the number was, five of us joined the Marines, and probably another four or five joined the Army or the Navy or the Air Force. I should think more than went to college that year, and so we joined the Marines because we just decided we wanted to be Marines, I guess, caught up in stories about the Marine Corps, and it struck me as a good way to spend a couple of years to delay going to work in the mines or someplace else locally.
And what year would that have been, and how old were you when you went?
I was 17 when I enlisted. I turned 18 within a few months, and I was in from 1957 to 1960. It was a time when I was not shot at, and I was not asked to shoot at anyone. So it was a good time.
And what did you learn from that experience? I mean, what did being a Marine teach you about life, and how did it affect your later life?
Well, it's something I reflect on more as I get older, and I think that being a Marine taught me to have self-confidence, a sense of discipline, to know how to work as part of a group, to depend upon other people who are part of my team. It certainly taught me those things, absolutely.
And where were you stationed?
Well, I was stationed most of the time over at Kaneohe Bay in Hawaii, and I spent some time in Atsugi, Japan. I shipped out of Treasure Island right here in the bay, and I came back to Treasure Island. That's where I was discharged from the Marine Corps in the spring of 1960.
Mm-hmm. And can it be said that the Marines broaden your horizon in the sense of you were abroad too in Japan?
I was in Japan, and yeah. I loved Japan. Later, when I went to school and when decided to go to graduate school, I would have become a Japanese historian, I think. Except I had a barrier of language, and I just, as an older student, by then I had a family. I couldn't invest the time it would require to learn the language well enough to do research. But I love Japan. I never got back to Japan for another 30 years, I guess. But I've enjoyed a number of trips there over the last 20 years.
So after the Marine Corps, you decided to go to college and get an were you eligible for benefits to do that?
No, not then. I wasn't. Yeah. There were no peacetime. There was not a peacetime GI Bill. Later, there was a peacetime GI Bill when I was in graduate school that retroactively covered people of my generation. I think I received a check of $100 a month or something like that, which was still real money in those days. But I went to the University of Wisconsin at Platteville, which was right across the border from the Galena, Illinois, where I lived. I lived at home for the first part of it. And after joining the Marines to avoid going to work in the mines, I ended up working in the mines. I worked for Kraft Foods in a Swiss cheese plant. I worked as a janitor. I worked as a bartender. And I ended up going to work in the mines, which was an interesting experience.
And let's talk about that. You actually were an explosives guy in the mine.
I was.
Tell us about that, because there must have been. Sounds like there was more danger in that than there was in the Marines.
Oh, there probably was.
Yeah.
You've done your research.
Yes.
No, I was. I was working on an underground, and one of the shift bosses came to me one day. I was working on a drill machine, sort of a backup on a drill machine, an assistant, where they were drilling holes in the face for setting explosives. And he said he had an opening as a powderman. And since I was a Marine, I must know something about dynamite. Would I like to be a powderman? I said, I never touched dynamite in my life. And I said, how much more will you pay me? And he said, I'll give you 20 cents more an hour. So I went from like $2.15 to $2.35 an hour, and I did a quick calculation. I said, sure, I'll be a powderman. Show me what to do. And so I became a powderman, and I worked setting dynamite charges, and it was an interesting experience. Obviously, handling explosives is a dangerous thing, but I'm not sure that 21, 22-year-olds think about those things very much. Far more dangerous was the trimming. Mm-hmm. We'd have to go in after an explosion and sort of trim off the loose rock before they came in and started hauling it away, and that could be dangerous. And there was somebody killed one summer when I was working there doing that, where he started trimming and a lot of the roof came down on him.
So I guess this was a good training for dealing with faculty when you became a president.
You certainly find your way through a lot of things. Yeah. But, you know, I kept it, and I would tell Dartmouth students this story. And when I was president of Dartmouth, I had on my desk a little knife that I used to use, because when you set dynamite charges, there's a paraffin wrapper, the red wrapper on a stick of dynamite, and you would split that. Then you'd tamp the sticks into the hole, and you'd split the paraffin so that the dynamite would collapse and you could push it in there tighter. And I kept this little, it was basically a homemade powder knife. It was a little piece of steel that had been sharpened, and there's some electric tape around it. And I kept it there, and I would show it to students and tell them I've always had it on my desk, and it reminds me where it is that I came from, and I hoped that they would never forget where they came from either.
You must have also learned during this period, because we're talking about being an undergraduate and then at the same time working in the mines on the weekend, they're very different realms, to say the least. But you mastered that, which I guess must have been an important learning experience.
I worked very hard.
Yeah.
I worked very hard. But when I was underground, that was in the summers I did that. But on weekends, I worked at the mine when classes were in session as a watchman. And it was overnight on Saturday and Sunday night, basically making sure the pumps were still running, that you kept the fires stoked up during the winter. We had coal fires in some of the buildings, and that there were no fires on the grounds. They're just looking after things. And so that job allowed me to spend the night sitting there reading and doing my homework.
So as an undergraduate, that's when you were able to act on your earlier interest in history?
I decided, well, I had a double major in history and English. I loved literature and I loved history, and I did a double major, but I also was preparing to be a secondary school teacher, a high school teacher. I did student teaching and training, and was prepared to get certified as a high school teacher. But I had some remarkable young faculty members at that time. The school was growing, as schools were in the 1960s. Roger Daniels, a very, very wonderful historian who recently retired, has written on the Japanese in California and the camps, and Roger was his first teaching job, and Roger encouraged me to think about graduate school in history, and I was willing to think about it. I had no idea what it was, and I applied for and received a Danforth Fellowship, which allowed me basically to go to any university in the country to graduate school. I ended up going to the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and part of the reason for that was that I did a senior thesis as an undergraduate on mining in Galena, the history of the opening up of the lead mines in my hometown, and there were some papers in the local library that nobody had ever looked at of the first federal superintendent of mines out there, and it was an interesting experience. The government managed it. It has some real relevance for Californians and for people in the West. The government managed those mines because lead was such an important commodity for paint, and most importantly for ordnance, for bullets. And so the government controlled these mines and managed them, and it was considered by the 1840s to have been a failure. And I think it was unfairly considered a failure, but there's a lot of political pressure to make the mines available privately. And had in the middle 1840s, the government decided it was not a failure. They may have had a different approach when gold was discovered out here a few years later and elsewhere in the Rocky Mountain West with all the mining there, but they kept pointing back to this experience and saying, we can't try to control federally these lands. Let's just open them up to individual prospectors and entrepreneurs. And I wouldn't want to project what might have happened had they done it differently, but certainly it was quite a sharp coincidence, and had real consequences that this failed. So that was my thesis, and I decided I wanted to go to the University of Wisconsin and work with Alan Bogue. Actually, I was going to go to Iowa. Alan Bogue was at the University of Iowa because people had told me that he was a good man to work on land policy and management of lands. And he moved from Iowa to Wisconsin in my senior year, and because I had a Danforth Fellowship, I was able to change my mind and say, now I think I'll go to the University of Wisconsin, which, of course, is one of the great American history programs in the country.
And who there also influenced you? Other people? Because I believe there you acquired quantitative skills?
I did.
Yeah.
I did, but I did first my master's thesis as an expansion on my undergraduate honors thesis, and the University of State Historical Society of Wisconsin published that as a book, The Galena Lead District. And I was very pleased as a graduate student to get a book published. But Alan Bogue actually was really doing the new political history at that time. He was writing a book on the Congress during the Civil War, and I became more and more interested in quantitative measurement. I worked with the Inter-University Consortium for Political Research at the University of Michigan. I got data sets for them, and my interest in mining, both personally for what I grew up, then intellectually because of my thesis work and the Galena Lead District book, led me to think about looking at politics and mining in a Western state, and I decided to work on populism in Colorado for my dissertation, and I used data analysis for that. I was in the early 70s, late 60s, one of the, quote, new political historians.
Mm-hmm. And I actually have your book here, which I'll show, The Politics of Populism. And I wanted to read something from the book because in the introduction you're explaining why you became interested in the politics of populism. You say third parties are a function of the existing political structure, the responsiveness of established parties, the accessibility of political institutions and decision makers, the extent of democratic processes, and the general sense of political efficacy. Consequently, it is altogether appropriate that populism be studied in its political context. I read that and I said, gee whiz, that sounds really relevant to today. So, yeah. And so I wanted to ask you.
Well, remember, it was the 60s, though, when I wrote that as well, the late 60s. So it was relevant then. I mean, the settlers in Colorado, and many of them originally were miners, but there are farmers out on the high plains, actually cattlemen first, and then increasingly farmers. Populism in the western states was considered largely an agricultural movement, but in Colorado, it really was the miners. It was the working underground miners up in the mountains that provide the backbone of populism, and they would go on to become radical union members, the Western Federation of Miners, the Wobblies, and other groups. There was a radicalism there, and there was a sense that the two political parties in Colorado in the first instance and then nationally were not representing their interests. Populism is a term, lowercase p, that's used, I think, quite generously to describe any number of movements in American politics. But the populism of the late 19th century, the populism that finally was decapitated by the Democratic Party when they nominated William Jennings Bryan for president in 1896, and Bryan reached out to bring in the disaffected Western agrarians into his party. That populism was one that was really had a very strong anti-corporate sentiment. There was a sense that individuals were losing control of their own lives to railroad companies, to large mining companies, to large land companies, to institutions that no longer were responsive to individuals. And so rather than, as people use populism today, to refer to an anti-government sentiment, these populists were looking to the government to come in and assist them. But that was not at all unusual in the West, because the settlers of the West had come to depend greatly upon the United States government. It was the United States government that built roads, that built railroads, that delivered their mail, that set up military posts, that protected them and advanced their good work, that through its land policy encouraged settlement and development. And so there was not an antagonism in the Western states then towards the government per se. There would be an antagonism toward government policy, specific things, but they looked out to the government as that institution representing them that could perhaps intermediate on their behalf with these large corporations that were increasingly able to control their lives.
Is there a lesson from these studies for today in the sense that you're suggesting at the end of the book that the parties really adapted to the grievances, and so populism was, you know, it passed from the scene, so to speak. Any lessons there for today, or is it
I think it's. I would be hard pressed to sort of do a linear thing that would lead to today, because I think today, what we see are dissidents, unhappy people on both the left and the right, and as they pull the two major political parties in their respective traditions, it's not clear to me that there is a real resolution for most of us likely to come through that process.
So you went after your degree, your first teaching position was at Dartmouth, and then you stayed there.
I stayed there. I was offered a job at Dartmouth in 1968 as an assistant professor of history. They offered me $10,000 a year, which was real money, and I jumped at it, and I went there, and I loved teaching. I loved teaching undergraduates. I loved teaching Dartmouth undergraduates because I would always think of my students as students who, very few of whom would go on professionally to be a historian or a history teacher, and I I wanted to have the opportunity with some of the best students in the country to let them know how a historian thinks, what it is that one can, what it is that history can provide for us as we think about the problems of our time.
And briefly, what was that? In other words,
well, I kept trying to tell them that the thing they have to look out for is the idea of history as sort of analogy, or history repeating itself, and where people would look to history and say, aha, here's the lesson that we need to use from history. And there's a real danger to that, because there is a uniqueness to each situation. What we have to learn from history is how to think about how this particular situation evolved. What are the component parts of it? But we are free agents. We have a free will then to determine how it is we're going to respond to this. And when I was, and we'll be talking later about my lecture yesterday and some of my work. But when you look at something like the Vietnam War, there is a tremendous reassessment now of our foreign policy, with people trying to, quote, learn the lessons of history from Vietnam. And what I point out is that those people who led us into Vietnam thought they had learned the lessons of history, and theirs was a history of analogy. They looked to Munich, they looked to the French at Dien Bien Phu, and they said, here are the lessons that we have to remember. We can't make those mistakes again. And so I think that one has to be very careful using history in that way. Vietnam was a very complicated, it was an emotionally a difficult time. The emotions of Vietnam are still very much part of our calculations. But I think we have the lessons now that you hear when President Obama spoke at West Point about his determination to go into Afghanistan with more troops, that we are not going to repeat some of the mistakes of Vietnam. Well, that is something that we have to try to avoid, repeating mistakes. But we don't avoid repeating mistakes simply by pretending that now we're going to do something totally different, and that's a way to avoid mistakes.
Let me ask you the question this way, and maybe there isn't an answer. Is there a skill set that you can see as necessary for running a great university like Dartmouth?
I think those who can be most successful leading any complicated organization have to understand that complicated organizations still need to be reduced to some rather simple values and priorities. Who are we, and what are we about? I think running any complicated organization, particularly a university, where you have to reach out and bring people in, you have to understand the processes at work. You have to obviously respect the faculty and their role, and not simply respect them as people that need to be briefed on what's happening, but they need to be brought in trying to think about how it is that you might address situations. But presidents of great institutions are not simply those who do a referendum and look for the lowest common denominator among the faculty or any constituency to determine what to do. They have to have their own values. They have to have their own priorities. They have to stand for certain things. They have to make that very clear. This is what I stand for. And standing for things in a way that's firm but not inflexible or stubborn, I think, is just a crucial value. You've got to know that there are times to back off a little bit, and you've got to know when there are times that, no. I want to assert again why I think this is the way to do it. And it's a balancing act. I'm a great politics has become a pejorative word in our society, but I'm a political historian. I think politics today, as it's practiced in many parts of this country and nationally, is something that I do find repugnant. I don't like the way...
Because of what it's become.
Because of what it's become. But politics at its very best is the way that free and open societies and institutions and organizations work together and allow themselves a process to finally determine how it is to make decisions, and then to make a decision and to move on with it. Politics is a good thing in a democratic and free and open society.
It sounds like all elements of your background, which we've just discussed, contributed to your understanding of leadership, and not just the fact that you had held many roles within Dartmouth's...
Don't you think that's true of each of us? And it's hard for me to sort of do this the introspection or the self-analysis. I want to write something for my grandchildren, not for a bigger audience, about my own background. And I want to reflect on these things. But, you know, I grew up, as I said, in a relatively poor family. But I never felt poor because everyone in my community was more or less the same. So there was no sense of hierarchy there, at least not an obvious sense of hierarchy. I went to Catholic schools for several years with nuns. I was an altar boy in the days of the Latin Mass. I was a Marine at age 17. I studied history. I mean, all of these things contribute finally to the way that I think and relate to the world, but I would be hard-pressed to sort out which of these things make me function the way that I do or think the way that I do.
Mm-hmm. As president of Dartmouth, I know that you were involved in the reforming of the undergraduate curriculum, or maybe even before. Talk a little about that. I mean, what were some of the dilemmas in making undergraduate education more relevant?
Dartmouth has had really two comprehensive curriculum reviews, I think, in the last 60 or 70 years, and I chaired both of them, which is at least one more than any faculty member should be asked to take on in his lifetime, because it's a complicated thing, but it's a wonderful assignment as well. I did one. I was still an associate professor when the president, the dean of faculty, asked me to chair this task force in the late 1970s. And then as dean of faculty, I organized another one and chaired it myself in 1990, because I wanted us to still try to think about addressing some things, most of which we had not successfully addressed before. I think that the curriculum, when I think of the curriculum, I'm really talking about the degree requirements, because the curriculum itself needs to evolve based on the various disciplines that are part of a curriculum. I don't think that there's a master plan, or there can't be. There may be a master plan, or at least a strong, assertive faculty committee that determines, okay, we don't need this many courses on this subject because there are not that many students interested in it. I think that those are fair and legitimate questions, but they really have to do with the faculty looking after the business of the curriculum. We were focusing on the degree requirements, and so my interest was what is it that a graduate of a school like Dartmouth should have as part of his intellectual background, his CV, and that's a hard question, because everyone has their own very specific thing that they think need be a part of that. As a historian, I have trouble thinking of anyone who can go on to positions of leadership and responsibility without having some appreciation of history, obviously. But there are others who will say the same of mathematics, of economics, of physics, of whatever you name the field, and they can make a compelling case. And so we tried to think about those skills that students should know, and we also talked about the ways in which a major should prepare them. And I don't look at a liberal arts college as a major as being sort of pre-vocational. We have an advantage in that in thinking of the liberal arts. I looked upon a major as a way in which one developed confidence and mastery of a discipline, understanding some of the methods and the tools of a discipline, understanding some of the history of the discipline. And my interest, and then we finally secured this, were each student sort of having some sort of culminating experience in their major, a paper or something else where they would pull together the work of the major. We were able to get requirements for interdisciplinary courses into the curriculum, and I think that is important. I believe in disciplines, but life is interdisciplinary, and the problems of life are solved by thinking outside the boundaries of discipline. So we wanted to try to do that. We changed some of the old science requirements where students simply had to take some courses in the science division. to ask that they took a lab science. You can't learn, and I am not a scientist. I had trouble with science in high school and never touched it again. Chemistry, it was difficult for me. But I think you can't know how scientists work unless you get into a lab and take a laboratory course. And so we required that. And it was an interesting process. I think it's probably time to assess some of those things again. But these things are not written into concrete. Some people would write them into concrete. Everyone who presumes to have an education should have read this, should have studied that, should have done that. And I could make the same argument about a number of things, but we're talking about a process of educating young people to enable them to go on to a lifetime of continuing education, because education is not a degree is not the end of a process of education. Educated well and right, those students who walk out of an institution such as Dartmouth or Berkeley are prepared for a lifetime of continuing to learn. And what I keep trying to tell our students and our faculty and others that none of us can predict what students should know to function well in the world of 2025, which isn't very far off. And if they want to test us, go back to 1995 and think about how the world has changed since 1995, and think what courses we might have required in 1995 to prepare students for the world of 2010. And I'm not sure that there are courses as much as skills that would have enabled them to do that. And so what I tell students is that I want them to know how to relearn, to learn again, and importantly, to unlearn, because there are some things that we're teaching today that they're going to have to unlearn sometime in their lives. Somebody's going to say, you know, that no longer is a legitimate way to understand that problem. That no longer is a legitimate interpretation. That no longer is a legitimate methodology. And those people who cannot unlearn at age 40 or 50 or 60 are those who are going to have the greatest difficulty continuing to function well.
I know you've been involved in committees that are looking at the challenges of higher education as we look ahead. Especially a lot is changing because of the economic collapse of 2008 and so on. What are your reflections on do you think universities will adapt, or will they have to change themselves drastically?
I think universities will have to adapt, they will have to change, but so will our society's understandings of universities. I think one of the unfortunate things is a concept of education as being yet another interest group that is sort of elbowing its way of some sort of public treasury or public trough. Education is about the infrastructure of this republic, of this nation, of this society, of this state. And until we can understand that, we are going to continue to lose ground. You know, in the early 1970s, the United States led the world in terms of completion of high school, with high school education. We did for most of the 20th century. About 77% of our students had a high school, of our people, rather, the population in their 20s and beyond had a high school education. Now it's 67%. And now we rank something like 21st out of 27 industrial nations in the world. We are losing ground in something pretty fundamental. In the early 1970s, we ranked number 2 in the world in terms of college degree. We were behind only the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union had a far more lockstep method of marching everyone through some sort of degree programs. Now we are 11th, and we're losing ground. We're losing ground to the nations of Western Europe. We're losing ground to Korea and Japan and to other countries. We still are among the highest. If you look at those over age 55, we're second in the world. But if you look at those in their 20s and early 30s, we're 11th. What does that mean? It means that this generation who are going to be taking over leadership in this country do not have the educational tools widely distributed. We are not doing well with minority groups. We're not doing well with recent immigrants. And so I think that there has to be an understanding that education is a crucial part of the infrastructure of this republic. It's as crucial as highways or railroad lines or airports or bridges or anything else. In fact, those people who will build the bridges and the highways and the railroad lines are going to be well-educated people, and we have to simply do better than that. Now, Dartmouth is an institution that is always going to have a small number of students, and my vision for Dartmouth was to make certain that it was not simply a place for the privileged, and that's been a view that's been shared for a number of years. It was not mine, obviously. It was not original to me, but I was very pleased that half of our students were on financial aid. I was very pleased that 15-16% of our students were first-generation college students. I liked, as a first-generation college student myself, going out on the campus and thinking, you know, about 1 in 6 of these students have a mother and father who could not have imagined coming to a place like this, and that's crucial. Where we're sitting now, Berkeley, it is a flagship institution. It is a flagship not simply for California. It is a flagship university for this country. It is a flagship university for this world. And I think we all have to be concerned if a place like Berkeley is having difficulty making certain that it's accessible and available to a wide range of students, and making certain that the faculty here have the opportunity to continue to expand that which we know to force us to relearn those things that we have to relearn.
Your lecture here was on democracy and veterans, and I want to talk a little about that. And tell us a little how you became interested in this problem of educational access for returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, it's interesting. As a Marine, and there is sort of a once a Marine, always a Marine, but I was not somebody who spent my waking hours thinking about being a Marine. I had friends at Dartmouth that knew me for 20, 30 years, perhaps, who weren't aware that I had once been the Marines. It was not, I was proud of it, but it was not something that I wore on my chest. And during the Iraq War, early on, it was the Battle of Fallujah in late 2004, and some of the accounts that I read about the fighting there, some of the Marines there, just touched me deeply. I can't explain why then and there it did, but it did. And I spoke to a friend of mine who had been who was a retired Marine officer, a Dartmouth graduate, and said, I would like to do something, and I'm not sure what. And he said, why don't you go visit the wounded troops at Bethesda and talk about an education? And I said, how can I get permission to do that? And he said, I still have a friend in the commandant's office. Let me check. And he got back to me and got me permission to go to the Bethesda Naval Hospital, where there were a lot of Marines at that time. Many of them had been wounded in Fallujah. And so I went down there, and I went bed to bed and talked to them, asked them what happened to them, and tried to encourage them to think about continuing their education. Somebody encouraged me to go right after that to Walter Reed Hospital, where I met with the students, and I came back to Bethesda. And after the second or third trip, I realized that the questions that these young wounded veterans were asking me, I'm thinking about going to a college near home in Texas, and do they have a major in X? Or I'm hoping to enroll in a school back home in California, and because I've lost both my legs, are all the buildings accessible? Do they have elevators every place? Pretty basic stuff, but there's no one individual that can wander through a hospital or any group and answer those questions about every institution. So I contacted the American Council on Education. David Ward was president of the ACE, is the largest umbrella group for American institutions, ranging from community colleges to the great universities of this country, the great research universities. And David was willing to try to set up a counseling program at a couple of hospitals where he could then get somebody from the institution of interest to answer questions. And I agreed to help raise the money for it. And I raised $350,000 to start it, and it was pretty easy money to raise, Harry. It was really quite something. And that process then got me involved in some other things. The GI Bill, I realized that it really was not providing means for these young men and women to be able to pursue their college education. Somebody connected me with Senator Jim Webb of Virginia, a former Marine, and he and I spent an afternoon talking about how to proceed. He had a bill that wasn't moving along, and we met with Senator John Warner, who was also a Marine, and we talked about how to make certain that private institutions would have access to a new GI Bill, because at that time there's a disposition to top the tuition payment at a level that would not allow them to go to private schools. And I said, look, you have so many people had an opportunity to come to private schools. And so we worked out what was called the Yellow Ribbon Program, whereby I suggested that the difference, or the delta, as Senator Warner called it, between the top tuition at a private public institution in the state and that of the private would be split equally between Veterans Affairs and the institution. So we would have to put up some money, and that was became called the Yellow Ribbon Program, and that was part of the GI Bill. So I was pleased when this passed and was signed. It was difficult because there was a lot of resistance to it, because the Defense Department thought it would discourage reenlistment, which was important to them. And I just a few weeks ago, 10 days ago, I made my 20th visit. I was down at Bethesda Hospital and made my 20th hospital visit. I continue to do this, continue to encourage young people to think about going to college, because I think that this the group that I work with on the college board, their task force that looked at the way in which we are declining in terms of completion of college, this is a part of the response to that, because there are parts of the country, there are cities, there are neighborhoods, there are communities where nobody goes to college. It's not just randomly. There are certain places in this country, certain high schools, where 95% of the graduates will go to college, and there are other places where 5 or 10% will go to college. And we need to begin to break through that culturally. And a lot of these veterans are coming from these smaller communities where people have not gone to college. And so I'm encouraging them. I'm always telling them that they can do anything they want to do. They've already demonstrated that. And we have now 16 at Dartmouth, I try to keep in touch with them without being a mother hen or pestering them. But my door, even as a president emeritus, is open to them, and they're remarkable young men. These are all men at Dartmouth.
As a president, you were able to kind of influence the world view, so to speak, of what was happening to these young people and what we needed to give them. As a historian, you look at the present situation, and in your lecture you raise some very interesting points, and let's touch on them. The soldiers now, despite the difficulty of moving in the direction that you just moved, are being treated with respect in a way they weren't after the Vietnam War.
Yes, when I was invited by the committee and by Chancellor Bergenau to give the Jefferson Lecture, the committee had an interest in what I was doing for veterans, and I said, I don't want to just reflect on what I've done for veterans. As powerful and important as that is to me, I'd like to also think about it historically. And so I spent the last several months really focusing on the history of veteran policy in the United States. And you don't have to spend too much time in looking at this to realize that the real outlier is Vietnam. That the policies and the support have evolved with some ups and downs over time. But in terms of attitude toward veterans, we celebrate the veterans today. It's hard to go to a baseball game or a football game or watch the Super Bowl next Sunday. There will be some salute to armed forces there and to veterans. It's part of our culture. We are embracing and thanking these veterans, and they are due that. We did not do that with the Vietnam veterans, and that's what increasingly became an intriguing question to me, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. I don't have the answers by any means, but there have been many unpopular wars in American history. I think that Vietnam is an outlier in the sense that I don't think you'll find any other occasion when the public or some significant portion of the public has faulted those troops who have fought in these unpopular wars for the wars. And we did not treat the Vietnam veterans well. I think we realized that as a country by the late 1970s. There was a beginning change in that. You can see it by looking at Gallup and Harris polls, a recognition and acknowledgement that they were not well treated and an embrace of them. You can see it beginning in the 80s. President Reagan, really President Carter started, and then President Reagan, I think, really reached out to the veterans. It was important for him strategically in the way that he was thinking about the world. It was important to him politically, but it was also personally important to him. When I say veterans, I really mean the armed forces as much as the veterans, and embracing them. And I think by the time 9/11 came around, we already were disposed to be supportive of the armed forces. And I think that there are really few, if any, events in American history that had the emotional, that gave us the emotional jolt that 9/11 gave us. It did cause a lot of grief, it caused a lot of fear, and it caused a sense of true national unity. And I think that the armed forces became even more crucial to us. They were our protectors, and that caused us, I think, to reach out to them. And I think the great irony to me is that the war in Iraq very quickly became an unpopular war. There was significant disagreement about whether the war was justified when it began in March of 2003. And within a year or two, I think that there was an increasing swing in the United States. There were no weapons of mass destruction. There was greater and greater resistance to the idea of the war, and it was an unpopular war. Afghanistan was more popular because of 9/11, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, but I think within the last couple of years, it clearly has become unpopular. This has not been transferred to the kids who are fighting over there, unlike Vietnam. Vietnam was perhaps no less popular and no less unpopular, whatever the right description is, than these two wars today. But unlike Vietnam, we're not blaming the guys who are fighting it. And I'm going to spend some more time on this because I want to understand better this and some of the consequences of it.
Do you have any sense of what the difference was? Did it have to do with the fact that was a draft army, whereas now it's?
But you see, that's almost it may well have, but that would have led to greater unpopularity of the war because people were facing the draft. But that should not have been translated into unpopularity of those who are fighting the war. If anything, we should have embraced them more because they're more representative. In fact, it was a blue-collar war.
Vietnam.
We think of it as being a war because of the draft that was sort of equal opportunity, but it was not. Remember, there were college deferments and other sorts of deferments, and the kids who were dying in Vietnam tended to be very blue-collar in their background, absolutely. But I think it is interesting that there was a draft then, and 62% of the troops who were killed in 1969 were draftees. That's significant. That really says something. And of course, there are a lot being killed, a lot more than are today. There were 47,000 plus were killed in combat, another 11,000 were killed in non-combat activities in Vietnam. But I think today they're volunteers. So it's not that they have been dragged unwillingly into the army. They've said, yes, I would like to join. And nonetheless, this unpopular war is being carried out by people who are very popular. That's good. I'm surely not being critical of that. I'm trying to understand better why we didn't have a better understanding of Vietnam. But the 1960s was a time of a revolt, a revolution against many of the mainstays of American culture, and I think that you can't minimize that. It was crucial the people here in the Bay Area at the University of Wisconsin, where I was, there was an open revolt against the conformity that the military seemed to represent. Vietnam was a very well covered war by the press. There were far fewer restrictions on coverage of that war than the newsreels that came back from World War II in Korea. And indeed, there were fewer restrictions there than there are now in Iraq and Afghanistan. Indeed, beginning with Grenada in the early 1980s, the Defense Department put far more restrictions over the way the press would cover it. And so you had, I think by 1968, there were 630, 640 accredited journalists in Vietnam. And they could oftentimes catch a hop on a helicopter and go someplace and cover something. And among the restrictions on them was not to show American troops killed or seriously injured. And so that took away the capacity to sympathize with these guys. And in fact, you saw instead the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese mm-hmm. suffered horribly in that war, and I don't think we should ever minimize that. And so it was all of a sudden these were the baby killers who were over there. My Lai was a terribly important incident. And by the early 70s, polls were saying that most Americans believed that My Lai was fairly common in Vietnam. So Lieutenant Calley, rather than the boy next door of World War II, Lieutenant Calley becomes symbolic of the American kids who are over there. And Vietnam veterans would talk about moments of tremendous complexity, of moral ambiguity, of not knowing how to function in these situations. They would admit to that.
You pointed out in the lecture, and I would like to go over this with our audience, namely the different situation of the veteran of today because of the change in medical technology, the weapons, and so on. So, and I think you gave a figure of something like 7.3 to 1 wounded. Talk a little about that, because it's very important to help us understand really the importance of what you've done in terms of saying, well, what will all of these veterans who've been injured, and more of them are being injured and survive. Basically, what? How do we help them?
Yeah, in Vietnam, there were about 2.6 wounded for every one who was killed. So that meant that we were saving about, you know, of the 3.6 of the number who were wounded, about a significant number of them were being saved, 2.6 to one. In Iraq, it's about 7.3 to 1. We're saving a lot more of those who are wounded. And I think this is a remarkable thing. And it's really due to a lot of factors, to be sure. But I think that among them are advances in medical technology, particularly speed of delivery. These guys are picked up in a hurry. They're medevaced in a hurry. They're taken to some full facility hospitals in Iraq, and they're on their way to Germany within a day or two. Then they're on their way to Bethesda or Walter Reed or Brooke Army Medical Center shortly after that. They're getting tremendous care. They also have body armor that is pretty effective in protecting vital organs. But what is happening is that we're saving a lot of people who might well have died in the field or shortly after in a hospital in Vietnam. We're saving them. The amputations, there are more amputations. Body armor is not protecting limbs. There's more cognitive brain injury. There are more burns. People are inside of steel vehicles that are hit by IEDs. A significant portion of the injured in Iraq and in Afghanistan, more in Iraq than Afghanistan, are coming from explosives where people are inside of steel vehicles. And I think that this means burns. It means getting their bell rung, as they said, significant concussions. And one needn't go beyond the National Football League study to know that significant concussions can have a cognitive impact. And I think that, in fact, there's a linkage between that and PTSD. And I think that that's a significant problem of veterans coming out from this war. So we need to recognize that. I think that the hospitals have been overwhelmed, just as the Defense Department did not do a very good job in being able to project back in 2001 or 2003 that we'd still be fighting in Iraq in 2010 and Afghanistan in 2010. Nobody thought we were in for that long of a haul They did not understand the magnitude of the injuries coming back, and so the hospitals have just been overwhelmed by these numbers. And it's not just the simple numbers coming in; it's also because of the complexity of some of the wounds and injuries that these veterans are bringing back. That they need to have ongoing treatment, prostheses and fitting for prostheses and rehabilitation training. The burns are significant. When I think of some of the guys that I've seen and talked to who are in these hospital beds, some of them pretty fresh into the hospital beds. You know, their stumps sort of taped up and oozing blood and pus because they can't be fitted for prostheses until all the swelling goes down. It's such a difficult time. It just reaches out to you. I've spent times there where I want to go outside the hospital and just start crying because of what I've seen. But I've also always been inspired because I've never heard any of these guys whine or complain when I try to encourage them to think about going to school. They think they'd like to. What they often say, though, is, "I really want to go back to my unit." And at first I was puzzled by that, and I thought, well, they obviously are far more supportive of the objectives of this war than as the public as a whole. But what I came to realize is that the war and the war objectives are not significant in this case. They have bonded with their unit, and they want to be back. They want to try to help those guys out. And that's a big difference from Vietnam. I think one of the unfortunate things of Vietnam is that we sent these kids over there individually, not as a unit. And so they would come in as strangers, as the new guy in a unit, and find themselves out on patrol with a group of guys who have been on patrol together for several weeks or several months. And then and then they would come home alone on a charter plane and get out off the plane at San Francisco Airport, and nobody there to greet them, nobody to welcome them.
One final question, and possibly a brief answer. Is there a way that we can continue to support the soldiers in these ways that you're describing, but at the same time figure out a way to have a better discussion of the war aims and the direction of our
I think there are two different elements of that. I think we can support, as I said yesterday, in a democracy such as ours and under a constitution such as ours, the military does not start wars. If they do, we've got a far more fundamental problem. Wars are started by our political leadership. The military fight them at the command of the political leadership. And so the issue has nothing to do really with the military. It has to do with our political leadership. We don't do a very good job in debating these things. We have not had a declared war, after all, since World War II, since, December the 8th, 1941, we declared war against Japan, and then one or two days later against Germany. We've not had a declaration of war since then. We enter into these wars in some different ways, in some more complicated ways. And I think that the people are uneasy and uncomfortable. There were certainly complaints and concerns about going to Iraq in the winter of 2002-2003. There were fewer dissents of the idea of going into Afghanistan. That seemed clearer and crisper. Part of it, the emotions following 9/11, but there was in those mountains of Afghanistan was Al-Qaeda, who clearly had ownership over what happened in 9/11. And most people in this country and internationally understood the need for us to take care of that. Vietnam, the Tonkin Gulf resolutions, and we know that they were iffy at best in terms of those factors that led to it. Korea was a police action. And so we don't have a good and a free and an open debate, and we simply have to do that. And then it gets caught, of course, in a lot of emotions.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, and I want to thank you for being on our program, and thank you for coming to Berkeley to give the Jefferson Lecture on such an important topic. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Harry.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.